In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Such a simple sentence that describes the creative process that formed everything that we know. Yet describes a process that none of us can even remotely begin to understand. This first sentence in the Bible is one that sets the stage and automatically separates the people believing in an all-powerful Creator from the rest of the unbelieving world. From the very first lines of Scripture, Yahweh wanted it to be known that it was He who created it. And He said it in such a simple yet dramatic message that there should be no confusion on the subject. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. But instead of being awestruck by His power and His marvelous creation, man wants to explain away the Creator. Man constantly looks for reasons not to believe. And so evolution is now the predominant view in the world. It's interesting in that almost around the same time as Brother Thomas wrote Elpis Israel in 1848, another man with a very different viewpoint by the name of Charles Darwin was writing On the Origin of the Species in 1859. This later book has since become a Bible, so to speak, a religion in itself, giving atheists something to grasp onto, an alternative to a higher power. I say religion in that it takes a lot of faith to believe in evolution, as hopefully we'll show tonight. Unfortunately, this religion, this defiance of Yahweh, is becoming more and more prominent as it's being expounded almost universally in schools and universities across the world. And as if the belief of evolution wasn't bad enough, there is now a new threat to the truth, a mixing of the two beliefs. For a number of years, this mixing of truth and error has been allowed to exist in other fellowships. And not surprising, it's gaining more and more momentum. Just recently, I read a post on a social media site saying that regarding evolution, the Brotherhood has to get with the times. Otherwise, they feared they would lose all their young ones to the world. And another one said, the Brotherhood has to reconcile the apparent contradiction between evolution and the Bible. Otherwise, all our children will see the contradictions and lose their faith. And so they've created a new term, theistic evolution, a combination of both God's and man's views. Under human reasoning, it seems brilliant. It's more inclusive. Why not take advantage of exposing more people to Christ? Why not make changes to people or make changes to keep people from leaving the truth? And so they brought polar opposites together. This, of course, isn't the first time in history that the truth has been corrupted. We read in Romans, who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshiped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Brothers and sisters, theistic evolution is becoming a very serious problem among other Christadelphian groups. And although, as far as I know, it hasn't affected the Bereans, it could easily do so, particularly if we don't appreciate the ramifications of the belief and understand how it changes the very framework of our salvation. Unless we understand the significance of how it affects the truth, it could easily be allowed in as just another uncertain detail. One might easily say, well, maybe, with all the evidence they claim to have and all the scientists that agree with them, maybe they have a point. Or, I'm not a scientist. I can't argue against their science. So as long as they feel the Almighty had a hand in it, who am I to tell them they can't believe it? But does belief in the evolution, or this variation of it, this so-called theistic evolution, actually affect the truth? As we go through our lecture tonight, I hope to show the significance of the belief and the ever-increasing threat that our children and our young ones are encountering. A threat that's not only being taught in school, but also through Facebook and other social media, and even by other Christadelphians. Hopefully, we will identify and review the devastation that letting it in could do to the truth. In Isaiah, God says, "For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Tonight, I would like to start out with what a theory actually is in the scientific world. I would then like to review some of the ideas that can be proven, such as random mutations and natural selection. We will show how they can cause minor changes within a given cell, but have never been proven to cause or to be the catalyst to change one kind of organism to another kind. Then we'll discuss some of the arguments used by evolutionists, primarily the fossil record and universal common descent. We will discuss the beginning of life. And then lastly, we will discuss, does it really matter? Is our basic belief affected by the idea of evolution? And if so, how? Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary? There is no searching of his understanding. When one argues with an evolutionist, they tend to bring up that evolution is classified as a theory, and therefore, as a theory, it should be treated as a fact. They act as if theories are laws that cannot be disputed and compare it with the law of gravity. Then if you don't accept it, they claim that you're turning a blind eye to all the evidence and accepting a lie. Well, it's true that in scientific language, a theory is different than how we use it and use the word in our daily language, where someone might say, "I have a theory about," and that's equivalent to saying, "I have an idea about." In scientific language, ideas are called hypothesis, hypo, less than, such as in hypothyroidism, and thesis or theory makes the word hypothesis mean less than a theory. So a theory, then, is said to be an idea or a hypothesis that has been well-tested and has repetitively stood the test of time. Even though it isn't brought out much by evolutionists, it's important to know that hypothesis and theories both can be rejected. And in fact, according to the scientific method, a hypothesis or a theory can never be proven right. It can only be proven wrong. And they're said to be provisional. Doesn't exactly sound like a fact, does it? They have supporting tests that suggest it's accurate, but that's it. Theories are provisional ideas that, according to current knowledge, doesn't appear faulty. So for the theory of evolution, they say the supporting evidence from the vast fossil record and universal common descent has supported it enough that it's treated as if it's a fact, as if it's a given. They act, though, as if it's a law and shouldn't be questioned. Well, is that the truth? Is a major theory ever proven wrong? Let's look at a connected theory that scientists have come up with to predict how the universe began. They estimate that 13.8 billion years ago, the universe started as a mere speck, a single, infinitely dense point. And then they say the Big Bang happened. It's explained as a rapid expansion and distribution of the universe and has been the accepted theory of how the universe began for years. If you didn't believe it, it was claimed you weren't accepting the facts. There was so much support for it, in fact, that in October 2014, even the Pope came out and expressed that not only was evolution real, but so was the Big Bang theory. If you denied the Big Bang theory existed, you were ridiculed. Until now. Just this year, headlines to the science world rang out, "No Big Bang. Quantum physics now predicts the Big Bang theory is wrong." They now predict that instead of a starting point before which nothing existed, they're now saying the universe always existed. So which was it? But more importantly, how is it that a substantial, well-recognized and supported theory that has stood the test of time is now recognized as wrong? And if this theory can be wrong, so can the evolutionary theory. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God, For it is written, He taketh the wise in their own craftiness. I read on one of the theistic evolutionists' websites, who's in Central, that even if the theory of evolution was found to be false, there's still the facts of evolution that would have to be accounted for. And he's partially right. There are facts that can be observable and even reproducible. Where he is wrong is regarding which statements are facts and which are not. So let's look at the four main aspects that evolutionists use. Number one, random mutations causing changes to the gene. Number two, natural selection that causes a shifting in populations. Number three, the vast fossil record, which they claim proves evolution. And number four, universal common descent. The first two items, we could agree, do actually happen, but not with the results they claim. The vast fossil record does exist, but we will show doesn't prove evolution. And the last item, universal common descent, we will show has no validity. The habit that evolutionists have is to demonstrate conclusively that number one and number two are observable facts, but then they go a step further and say because these are verifiable, then all evolutionary theory must be true. These first two are often called microevolution. I don't necessarily like this term, but microevolution is said to be evidence of small changes, minute or micro changes in species that can occasionally help them adapt. What is not proven is that these small changes can actually lead to massive changes from one kind to another, or macroevolution. Now, it's probably been a good while since most of you here have perused a cell biology textbook and studied the DNA code. So bear with me just for a moment. I think it's important that we review just the bare basics so that we can better understand some of the arguments that are brought up. I promise you, it'll just take 1 minute. Each cell has a set of instructions, a blueprint that tells it what to do. This set of instructions is called DNA. It's a language. But in this language, it only has four letters in its alphabet. These letters always pair up with a friend, such that A always pairs with T, and G always pairs with C, and these are called base pairs. It's shaped like a ladder, with the rungs being pairs of these letters, and once formed, they twist to form what's called a double helix. The specific sequence of letters creates genes, which in turn tells the cell to make a specific protein. Each of these genes are a recipe in a giant cookbook. Now, in order for the cell to make protein, the DNA is copied to RNA, which is transported out of the nucleus of the cell and then translated by a ribosome into a specific protein. Now, if all this sounds confusing, just remember, DNA is used to make RNA, RNA is used to make proteins, and proteins are the building blocks. So that's the very basics that we need to be able to grasp these concepts. Now, let's analyze the first point that evolutionists use to argue their side, random mutations. A mutation is a change in DNA. This can and does commonly occur in all organisms. It can be caused by viruses or chemicals or radiation. When the DNA code changes, it can either have no effect, or it can change what the gene produces, or it can lead to the death of the cell. But almost always these mutations are harmful. Now, there are rare exceptions, and one of the examples that's almost always brought up is sickle cell anemia. Sickle cell anemia is caused from a mutation in the hemoglobin gene, which causes the gene to be shaped abnormal, like a sickle, instead of like a donut. Now, you can see in this chart that a single mutation in the DNA leads to a different RNA, which then produces a different protein, a different hemoglobin. Normal hemoglobin is flexible. It can squeeze through narrow arteries easily. But sickle cells are hard and less flexible and cause blockages to form. And then the patients develop sickle cell crisis, which is a very painful condition as the downstream tissue dies of lack of oxygen. Another common mutation that we can all be affected by is antibiotic resistance. Unfortunately, antibiotic resistance is something that we're encountering on a daily basis now. And some of this resistance is thought to be because of mutations in the bacteria's genes. These mutations are facts. They do happen, and they can affect the organism. What they have never been shown to do is change one organism to a different organism. Yahweh has created this amazing organism, or these amazing organisms, but He's also created an incredibly complex system by which all these organisms interact and are affected by each other. And we should never lose sight that it's all because of His power. David said, "I will praise Thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are Thy works." This brings us to the next section, natural selection. Natural selection is the gradual process by which heritable traits become either more or less common in a population. The term was introduced by Darwin in his book and is said to be the key to evolution. The example almost always brought up is the peppered moth in the UK. It's postulated that as the Industrial Revolution increased, it caused dark soot to blacken the trees, and this gave darker moths a better chance of surviving as they were more camouflaged. Over time, the dark moths predominated until the Clean Air Act of 1956, and then dark moths became rare again. Now, on a side note, there's actually evidence that this may not have actually happened, but still you can see how the principle would work. Now, let's take example of sickle cell anemia, and look how natural selection has had an effect. Malaria is a serious problem, particularly in Africa, where a child dies every 60 seconds of it. Malaria is transmitted by mosquitoes, which then affects an individual's hemoglobin. However, people with sickle cell trait have a natural resistance to the malaria, which allow them to survive in malaria-prone areas like Africa. So this trait has given the individual an advantage that could allow that group to survive while the group without the trait might not. And so one could identify a shift in the population because of this condition. Another related phrase is survival of the fittest. It pushes organisms that are better suited to an environment to flourish, while those that aren't suited are more likely to die. But this works on an organism that is already in existence. These organisms, this DNA, must already be present for this to work. This is microevolution. It's a small, minor change of an already existing organism. It isn't changing one kind to a different kind. And so a moth is still a moth. A bacteria with antibiotic resistance is still a bacteria. And a person with sickle cell anemia is still a person. "Know ye that the Lord, He is God. It is He that hath made us, and not we ourselves. We are His people and the sheep of His pasture." Now let's focus on the last two items: the fossil record and universal common descent. You see, the evolutionists will use the data that we do agree upon regarding mutation and natural selection and make one think that it's all one uniform theory and that it's all factual. But these last two have no proof despite their claims. According to the evolutionary model, or evolutionary tree, it is claimed that life started out as a single cell and gradually, over millions of years, continued to change and develop new creatures. They draw out this evolutionary tree that, over time, gets more branches and more diversity. Now, if there was truly evidence of gradual evolution of the species over time, one would think that the fossil record would clear up all doubts. You would anticipate that as you go from one deep layer to a shallower layer, that you would find gradually evolving creatures. Would make sense, right? What do we find? Not a slow, gradual development over time, but instead an explosion of almost every major living body plan known as phyla, all during a single point or a single time period. Interesting. All at once, you say. This has become known by scientists as the Cambrian explosion. This is not debated. It's well recognized. An explosion of life of almost every major body plan known to man is thought to have developed during this time period. Don't you find that strange? Or maybe miraculous? It is claimed that this occurred in a relative small time period, around, they say, 540 million years. Now really think about this. If almost all the phyla we know formed at that time period, but yet they say, using their time scale, another 500 million years have occurred since then, why haven't we seen exponentially more body plans or phyla form since? In fact, they admit just the opposite is happening. Over time, they estimate that a majority of Earth's species have gone extinct, and that there are actually far less species now than then. It's a quote from Wikipedia. More than 99% of all species, amounting to over 5 billion species that have ever lived on the Earth, are estimated to be extinct. It takes a lot of faith to believe in evolution. In Zechariah, we read, "The burden of the word of the Lord for Israel, saith the Lord, which stretcheth forth the heavens and layeth the foundations of the earth and formeth the spirit of man within him." Now, a simple search will show that there's so much debate on how inaccurate dating methods truly are. A scientist doesn't typically date the fossil itself. They date the material around the fossil, the layer that the organism was deposited in. So using that, let's take an example. This is a picture that shows a fossilized tree standing upright, going through many layers of geological strata. Remember, each of these layers are thought to be millions of years of geological history. And this tree is traversing many of these layers. So based on the typical methods of dating, they would have to assume that this tree grew over 100 million years. Houston, I think we have a problem here. These are called palustrate fossils, indicating they're present in more than one geological strata, and in this case, many strata. It indicates that many, if not most, of the fossils we find were caused by a sudden geological catastrophe, such as a flood, that rapidly buried organisms and trees, causing them to be trapped in an upright position and then fossilized quickly. Otherwise, it would have been decomposed as layers just slowly, year after year, built it up. It wouldn't have been there. It would have decomposed over time. So isn't that interesting? A sudden catastrophe, possibly from a flood. Oh, Lord God, behold, thou hast made the heaven and the earth by thy great power and stretched out arm, and there is nothing too hard for thee. Now let's go to the last and what evolutionists say is their most compelling argument. It's also the most common argument used against creationists, this idea or this false idea of universal common descent. This is the idea that all life came from a single common ancestor, starting with one cell and then gradually increasing in complexity and then diversity until we arrive at all the life forms we have today. Their argument lies in that there are so many similarities between organisms, as well as the similarities in the genetic code. They've used this code to try and map out their evolutionary tree. One of the more commonly brought up examples said to give support for this universal common descent is the Gulu gene. Vitamin C is called a vitamin because our body requires it, but can't produce it on its own. Therefore, we have to consume it. If we don't get enough vitamin C, we get scurvy and we die. Most mammals have an enzyme called Gulo that helps change glucose into vitamin C. However, primates such as chimps and gorillas and humans, along with one rodent, the guinea pig, they have to ingest vitamin C. They can't form it themselves. These primates and the guinea pig have the gene to produce Gulo, but it's said to be a pseudogene, meaning it doesn't work as expected. It's claimed to be defective. Now, the evolutionists will argue, why would an intelligent designer just leave the gene out rather than put a defective gene in us? And then they will also say, because certain primates all have this defective pseudogene, It implies they all inherited it from an ancestor that was the originator of this defective gene and then passed it on to the rest of us. Well, if that's all we had to go on, we might be scratching our heads and wondering how to answer them. Here's a quote from Wikipedia. The loss of activity of the gene for Gulo has occurred separately in the history of several species. Gulo activity has been lost in some species of bats, but others retain it. The loss of this enzyme activity is responsible for the inability of guinea pigs to enzymatically synthesize vitamin C. Both these events happened independently of the loss of the suborder of primates, including humans. So if they admit that the Gulo gene is defective in more than one unrelated species, it destroys their argument. How can one use this argument to determine with any conclusiveness that two species are related, particularly when non-related species have also lost it? Here's another point to remember when you hear an evolutionist talk about pseudogenes, or a similar term they call as junk DNA. It's always been claimed that they're defective genes, but more and more we're finding out that they're actually not defective. They're finding over and over that they do have function and are necessary parts of the genetic code. Again, showing that their arguments are based on supposition and not facts. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? So to back up and review the basic argument of the universal common descent, it is that related species have very similar genetic code, and therefore they claim they must have inherited it from an ancestor. Remember, DNA code is really a language. It's a cookbook of how the cell is to function, and it describes what it is to make. Most cells function very similarly, with very similar structures. Doesn't it make sense, then, that the more similar an organism is structurally, the more similar the DNA will also look? For example, doesn't it make sense that a wolf's DNA and a dog's DNA is very similar? They look similar, they act similar, they eat similar things. Similarly, doesn't it make sense that a recipe for a blackberry pie would look very similar to a recipe for a blueberry pie? Now bear with me, and let me pose an experiment for you. Let's pretend we're all scientists for a second. Let's imagine two ancient cookbooks are found, one in Canada and one in Texas. Upon reading the books, each is found to be a collection of recipes, and both are extremely similar and, in fact, has only one difference among the thousands of their pages. The first found in Canada includes the ingredient sugar. The second book, found in Texas, it has, instead of sugar, the word jalapeno. Otherwise, the book's the same, the recipe's the same, the language is the same, the code is the same, all the same. Which would make more sense? That this is the same author who knew the audience of each of these books, that is, the location that they were going to be going to, and made the recipes applicable for that region, that there was an intelligence behind the design, and therefore kept the same basic framework, the basic recipe, the basic code the same? An experienced cook, an intelligent designer, or the other option, that both books were products from an original copy that, incidentally, they say came about by randomly grouping of letters, and that this was made by a printer years ago. The original book started out with the ingredient salt, and over a process of millions of subsequent printings, a smudge on the printer kept changing the letters bit by bit, and gradually over time, mutations occurred and eventually came to its current condition, with one book having sugar and a much later printing saying jalapeno. This latter scenario makes absolutely no sense, does it? Yet that's exactly what is being told. We're being told to believe when they argue the similarities in DNA. They're saying that it indicates that all life came from an original life form. Not just incredible odds, but foolishness that would never happen. We're told to ignore the fact that God laid out the universe and filled it with creatures, some who are very similar in structure and therefore very similar in DNA, but instead believe that natural selection and random mutation gradually created so many life forms that we can't even identify them all. But instead, doesn't the fact that these life forms all have similar DNA actually strengthen the argument that one designer created them all? An intelligent designer, an all-powerful creator who designed all that we know. Of course, then, there are going to be similarities. Why wouldn't the Elohim reuse parts of the basic cell blueprint, particularly when the result has been so amazing? It takes a lot of faith to believe in evolution. Thou sendest forth thy spirit, they are created, and thou renewest the face of the earth. Now, evolutionists believe that all life forms started from a single cell. How did this first cell start? The study of this is called abiogenesis, the beginning of life from non-living matter. The study of the beginning of life is admittedly one of the many major missing parts of evolution. How did life actually start? And how did it all happen all at once to allow the creature to continue to live? You can read the quotes from prominent scientists regarding the possibilities or the impossibilities of life starting on its own. So much so that Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the DNA double helix structure, was a proponent that life must have come from another planet to start out the process, as he realized the odds were so realized that the odds of it happening on its own was too great to actually happen. Man may speculate all they want, but Yahweh has already told us how it happened, if he will listen. Through his spirit he created them. Now, the smallest free living organism that we are aware of today is a type of bacteria called mycoplasma. It has 525 genes, and to put that in perspective, humans have over 30,000 genes. It takes 350 enzymes for the smallest of bacteria to actually work. And it's speculated that at a bare minimum, the bacteria would have had to be able to make 10 amino acids on its own to be able to survive. Now, what are the probabilities that just one of these amino acids would randomly come together to form a functional protein? Just one. Interestingly enough, a study was done looking into these odds. The study was peer-reviewed and then published in the Journal of Molecular Biology, authored by Douglas Axe. He determined that among all the possible mutations, the probability of all the possible amino acid combinations randomly generating one, just one, functional protein by mutation is 1 in 10 to the 74th power. 1 in 10 to the 74th power. Well, the evolutionists read this and automatically put a spin on it and say, you see there? It can happen. Given enough time, it can happen. There's a chance for this one amino acid to form. Do you know how big that number is? 1 in 10 to the 74th power? That's a lot of zeros. To put that in context, it is estimated that there are 10 to the 78th power atoms in our entire galaxy. Do you see the absurdity of life randomly beginning? Even scientists see that this is a problem. And these numbers are in reference to only one protein. Now let's pretend that despite all the impossible odds, the amino acids actually did randomly come together in just the right sequence. The enzymes came together just exactly at the same time, and 4 billion years ago, out of this primordial soup, they say, arose this single, marvelous mycoplasma. Imagine this first life form floating around this primordial soup. And then it says, okay, let's eat. What does a mycoplasma need to eat? It needs other living things. It can't survive on its own. Would it then have to wait another 1 billion years for another mycoplasma to form? Now, admittedly, the evolutionists claim that this first bacteria must have been one that could use either thermal or photosynthesis to actually survive. Do you know how many genes it would require for that to happen? I know this is getting technical, but It's a short slide here. According to this article from the National Academy of Sciences, Defresny et al. Mentioned that Prochlorococcus, which happens to be the dominant photosynthetic organism in the ocean, has 1.75 million of those base pairs we talked about, and 1,884 genes. That's three times as big as the mycoplasma. Now, this all happens to be the smallest of all the photosynthetic organisms known to date, and considered, as it says at the bottom, because of its compactness, to approximate the minimal gene complement of a photosynthetic organism. Now, we already showed that the smallest organism, having 500 genes, would take astronomical odds to randomly occur. But the smallest organism that can actually make its own energy is three times that big. It's like telling Henry Ford, you can't mass produce the first auto with a gasoline engine. You have to start out with a solar-powered car. Oh, and by the way, you have to do it by randomly throwing objects into your factory. But don't worry, you have all the time you need to do it. Take all the amount of time you want. It takes an incredible amount of faith to believe in evolution. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lust shall heap to themselves teachers having itching ears, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned into fables. If you believe in the inspired word of God, you have to take it as it says. You can't just adjust it to fit your own view. It has to fit together as a beautiful mosaic that comes together as a masterpiece. The scriptures are clear that it was God who created it all, that he did it in 6 days and rested on the seventh. Moses believed this, Paul believed this, and most importantly, Christ believed this. You can't find evolution in the Bible. You can't find a hint of it. It's not in the Word. Instead, you find straightforward passages, such as the one in Nehemiah, where it says, Thou, even Thou, art Lord alone. Thou hast made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their host, the earth and all the things that are therein, the seas and all that is therein, and Thou preservest them all, and the host of heaven worshipeth Thee. Now we're coming to the most important part of this talk. How important is it that we understand the correct view of creation? What are the ramifications of believing in this so-called theistic evolution? Now let's step back a second and review. An evolutionist believes that life started over the last 4 billion years and that man came on the scene about 150 to 200,000 years ago. They believe that there is no God and that everything has happened because of natural selection, random mutation, and chance. So it's obvious that evolution and the Bible are mutually exclusive. They can't exist together, as only one is right and the other must be wrong. A theistic evolutionist has similar views as the evolutionists, but they also feel that God had a hand in starting the creation and may have nudged it where needed to allow it to make man. They surmise that man slowly evolved and at some point along the way was deemed to be able to have enough intelligence to understand Yahweh's principles. And at that point, God selected two from the race and called them Adam and Eve. So theistic evolutionists feel that the earth was already populated by a hominoid race when Adam and Eve came on the scene 6,000 years ago. They believe that Cain and Seth married women from this already fictitious race. Now we come to one of the many major doctrinal problems with believing in theistic evolution. How is it that man could have lived and reproduced and, more importantly, died prior to Adam? To make this statement work, you have to change a lot of scriptures. 1 Corinthians says, And so it is written, the first man, Adam, was made a living soul, and the last Adam was made a quickening spirit. One might try to spin that as a politician would, but it's clear here who the first man was. He is called out by name. Was Paul confused when he claimed Adam was the first man? He couldn't have been more plain about it. Next, recall what was told to Adam and Eve after they sinned. Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children. And to Adam he said, In the sweat of the face of thy See, in the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return into the ground. For out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. So first we're told that women would have to, at that time, begin having children. Adam was told he would have to work for food, and both were told that they would ultimately die. So if this was their punishment, what was happening all around them? You know, according to the theistic evolution, this was already happening. But the scripture is clear. We're told in Romans 5:12, "Wherefore as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned." Now, to try to make this all make sense, the theistic evolutionist now has to change their idea of what this and many other verses mean. They have to change what causes death, because in their world, death had been happening for millions of years. Therefore, they've had to change their views on the nature of man. And since Christ was one of us, they've had to change their views on Christ's nature. Is the atoning work of Christ important to us? Is understanding the root cause of death important to us? Is understanding why Christ had to die important to us? Now you can see the ramifications of their belief. How one simple change to God's unchanging word starts one of many dominoes to fall and collapses a beautiful picture. For since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. It couldn't be more clear, could it? Adam was the first man. Adam sinned and was punished, leading to his death. So what does the theistic evolutionist say at this point? What can they say? If they aren't going to pick Yahweh's word over man's wisdom. Well, let me tell you, another domino falls, and this is what they say. Adam wasn't real. This is all symbolic language. And here's another actual quote. "The Genesis account is a story, meant to teach lessons, but not actually real." Jesus felt Adam was real when he quoted Genesis in Matthew 19, and he answered and said to them, "Have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female?" Paul felt that he was real. 1 Timothy 2:13, "For Adam was first formed, then Eve." If the 7 days of creation are only a story, as some of the theistic evolutionary group claim, or maybe a myth, as they say, then at what point do we start believing in Genesis? Is Abraham also a myth? Is the scripture not truly inspired? Or is it just vast confusion? The dominoes keep falling. If you believe in theistic evolution, many basic teachings, many clear principles have to be changed and actually have to fall like a line of dominoes to accommodate this error. If Adam wasn't literal, how about the lineage of Christ? If you truly believe that Adam was a myth, how do you reconcile that one of Christ's ancestors was said to be Adam, which was the son of Enos, which was the son of Seth, which was the son of Adam, which was the son of God? Do you see how many changes have to be made to accommodate evolution? God does not change. One other point to make regarding the days of creation. Some have argued that the 7 days of creation were actually large periods of time, 1,000 years or more, and not the 24-hour periods that we know it is. The Bible is pretty clear on this, that there were 24-hour literal days. First, consider how each day of creation is identified by the repetition of the phrase, "and the evening and the morning." Just makes sense, does it? Also, if each day was longer than a typical day, Adam, being made on the sixth day, would have lived through the seventh day and would have been over 1,000 years of age. But we're told in Genesis 5:5 that when he died, he was 930. And then we're told clearly in Exodus that Moses understood this to be 6 literal days. 6 days may work be done, but in the seventh is a Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. Now, as we come to the end of this talk, let's keep in the forefront of our minds the incredible, awesome power of Yahweh. He has made us an incredible world. He has made us amazing bodies. And He has developed a plan by which we have an opportunity to become one with Him. Instead of a mirage called the evolutionary tree based on man's dying theories, He has given us a chance to partake of His true tree of life. Blessed are they that do His commandments, that they may have the right to eat of the tree of life and may enter in through the gates into the city. Let us hold fast the words and the plan that He has given us. Let us not infuse a conflicting idea developed by atheists that distorts the true message. Let us be in awe of what He has done and appreciative for what He has given us and not deny His incredible power, for the time is short. For the word of the Lord is right, and all His works are done in truth. He loveth righteousness and judgment. The earth is full of the goodness of the Lord. By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of His mouth. He garnereth the waters of the sea together as an heap, and He layeth up the depth in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of Him. For He spake, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast.